So we're at day 20, starting a new chapter, chapter 14. New batch of homework due. Stapler on my desk, but in any case,
it's like a pile of spare things.
Okay. Let me talk more about integrals. So, chapter 13 kind of gets this idea started of area between curves. At the end of chapter 13, last thing we're working on with these so-called definite integrals. We have this connection between antiderivatives and area under a curve. So you can get the area under a curve by finding an antiderivative and then looking at the how much does the antiderivative change as you go from one end of the curve to the other. Now, there's a sort of generalization of that. Here, the bottom line is the line y equals 0, right? The x-axis. And if I have instead two curves, one of them's on top of the other, then it turns out that the area can just be found as an integral. Remember, there were several notations for these definite integrals. But they all end up meaning, computationally, they end up meaning take the antiderivative and find its change over change from inputs, left input, right input. But see here. In this case, if you want to find the area, you have to subtract the y-coordinates. The reason that works is because you could imagine slicing this thing up. And moving each of those bars there and here. We could imagine graphing y equals g minus x, measuring the differences in height between these things. And this would be the same area as that. You just imagine taking each of these little slices and moving it a little bit. So that you're sort of pushing the bottoms of them so that they're all level. And it actually works if you use really, really thin slices. You get the same area. So use this to solve a problem. Let's say find the area between the parabola y equals x squared plus 1 and the line y equals 2x. That's not quite right. Let me make it a little easier. Let's just do x squared and 2x. Yeah. Problem wasn't quite well posed before because it wouldn't be clear what it meant by between plus 1. Look at this one. Here's y equals x squared. Now, here is y equals 2x. As you can see, they cross each other two places. So you can find the area in between. You could get that picture on your graphing calculator. And you can also deal with it algebraically. If you don't want to have to come up with a picture, you could just look at this and figure out where they cross. And we're going to need to know exactly where they cross. I believe they cross at x equals 0 and x equals 2, but let's see. So let's call the first one x squared, the second one 2x. So then solve f of x equals g of x for x. X squared equals 2x. Well, let's see, that's the same as x squared minus 2x is equal to 0. That factors x times x minus 2. Pick the polynomials to make it easy. So either x is 0 or x minus 2 is 0. So x is 0 or x is 2. So it does indeed cross at the curves cross at x equals 0 and x equals 2. And fine, but still, if you want to get the area, you might be a little worried about, which curve is on top? If you have my picture or you have your calculator's picture, maybe you can tell, in between where they cross, the 2x curve is on top. But if you're not sure, we can make it a little test, right? Purely algebraically. So between x and equals 0 and x equals 2. Right? So I'll just pick 1. Okay. I just made up a number here. I could have used any number between 0 and 2. I just picked an easy one. Okay. F of 1 is 1. G of 1 is 2. Okay. So G is on top. Therefore, the area will be an integral, and we're going to go from the left to the right intersection points, and we're going to take the top curve minus the bottom curve. That would be the informal way of describing it. And more precisely, We're going to integrate from x equals 0 to x equals 2. And we're going to have the top curve, at least the top curve in this region, which is 2x, minus the bottom curve. And that will give us the area. Okay. So here we need antiderivatives. Okay, so who knows an antiderivative of 2x? That's a derivative. We want antiderivative. X squared has derivative 2x. So x squared is an antiderivative of 2x. X squared. And who knows an antiderivative of x squared? A function whose derivative is x squared.
2x
squared. No, 2x squared has derivative 4x. What? One half x?
Yeah, one third of x cubed.
Yeah. If we take the derivative of x cubed, we get a 3x squared, which would cancel the 3 downstairs to give us the x squared. Right? And remember the general rule. So if you couldn't remember that 2x has an antiderivative of x squared, you could think of that as 2x to the 1 power, right? And use this rule. So if you want, you can put a little 1 there to be, think about how I got this. In any case, since this is a definite integral, we're actually not going to get a function or a family of functions where you can change them by a constant. Instead, we're just going to get a number. Right? We're supposed to get an area, so we better get a positive number too. So we get an antiderivative, and we look at how the antiderivative changes as we go from x equals 0 to x equals 2. And that total change in the antiderivative represents the total growth in the area as we move from having no area to having all the area. You can think of this as an area growth function. So continuing, plug in 2. Plug in 0 and see what the difference between those two outputs is. 4 minus 8/3 minus nothing. Okay. 12/3, 8/3, 4/3. If I did my arithmetic correctly. Good. We got a positive number. And we wanted a positive number for an area. If you do one of these problems, you can get a negative number. Probably you put the wrong function on top, and you just need to switch which function you're subtracting from which. It's also possible you made some other kind of mistake, but one of the easy mistakes to make here is to mix up which function is on top and which function is on the bottom. Right? If I had switched them, I would have gotten negative 4/3. So that would be an easy thing to check for. You somehow got to that negative area in your digits. Why am I getting a negative area? And of course, you can also have your calculator do this integral, I hope, to confirm that you didn't make some other kind of mistake in getting from here to here. I think on my calculator, I wanted to do step 3. I would enter in, there's a special button for the integral. I think I have to hit shift or seconds, to get it. And then I would do 2x minus x, then the power symbol, square it, comma x, comma 0, comma 2, right? The thing your calculator won't do for you is actually set up the integral, right? Because your calculator can't read my problem. It can't read English very well, so it's not going to know what integral is appropriate. But if you can figure out the appropriate integral, your calculator may take it from there, depending on the calculator. And in the syllabus, I recommended a very fancy calculator that can not only give you a decimal like 1.33333, but can even give you the exact fraction, right? Questions about this? This stuff here gets applied in the second section of chapter 14 in various ways. They give examples of various concepts used in the social sciences, business, life sciences, etc., where you actually want the area between a curve, between two curves, say, because it has some meaning to you. And I'm going to focus on an economic concept called the surplus. We'll get to what that means. Before I go into that, though, did anybody have any questions regarding the homework we just turned in? Any problems you particularly wanted to hear my take on? I'm going to take a few pictures of the board while you're thinking about that. Any questions? Yes.
Can we look at homework 17, number 1?
Yeah. Remind me which one that is. Is that in the book?
No, it's you gave it to us.
Okay, it's on the board. Yeah. I can pull up my own board photo if need be, if it's a long question. Let's see. What was the question asking again?
Given a credit card balance of $2,000,
yeah,
12% interest rate. How long will it take to pay off the whole balance using monthly payments of $50 a month?
Okay.
And what will the total payments be?
Okay. Let's see here. Okay, so on the one hand, it's going to grow by 12% a month. So I'm going to do everything in years. And actually, no, hold on. We'll do it in months. That's fine. And you said we're going to pay $50 each time.
Yes.
Okay. Maybe I should. How about I use B for balance? Okay. Okay. So the balance grows. By 2K, I just mean $2,000. The balance grows at a rate of, it's 12% per year, right? That's the annual rate of interest, just 1% per month. A credit card charging 12% per month is, that would be like, about 200% per year with the compounding. That'd be insane. That would be a payday loan or something ridiculous. Not that crazy credit card. Okay, so 1% per month. And we're paying $50 a month. Okay, so this is the scheme. So on the one hand, it's increasing at a rate of 0.01 times the current value, but then it's also decreasing at a rate of 50. So on net, I think it's going to be decreasing because 1% of this. I switched from A to B, didn't I? You can use A or B in your homework or whatever letter you want, right? But B stands for balance in my mind here. Oh, look at this. 1% of 2,000 is 20. So right from the start, this rate of change will be at negative 30. And as the balance gets lower, the 1% of the balance will become a smaller and smaller number. So over time, the balance will go down even faster, right? As the balance gets close to zero, you'll be paying off at a rate of 50 instead of at the initial rate, which is 20 minus 50. So it's going to start out at a rate of $30 per month decrease, and it's going to ramp up to eventually a $50 rate. So, okay, $2,000. At first, you're only paying it off at $30 a month. Later, you're paying it off. Towards the end, you're paying it off at almost $50 a month. Right? I mean, you're always paying $50, but later on, the interest isn't canceling as much of your work. So you'd imagine the time it takes is some number between 2,000 divided by 30, which would be close to 70 months, and 2,000 divided by 50, which would be 40 months. Okay, so somewhere in there. Okay, so what we do is we multiply both sides by dt, okay, we're going to get time on one side and the stuff about the balance on the other side. So I multiply both sides by dt, divide both sides by the RB minus 50. Like so. Think of this as me solving for dt, because that'll get all the time stuff here and all the balance stuff over there. Then I integrate. Again, antiderivative of both sides. Keep in mind, we want to, what time is it when the balance finally gets down to zero? Okay. If you're very slow about paying off this credit card, only $50 a month. And then there was also the second question of total payments, right? Now, the total payments, you're paying $50 a month, so that's going to be 50T, right? However many months you have to pay it times 50. So that was the other part of it. So you'll see how much that is compared to the $2,000 initial balance. Right? Okay. So did anybody get this problem?
I got similar to what we're doing, but instead of using months, I changed it to year.
Okay. Yeah. You could use years. So then this would become 600 a year, and then instead of a 0.1, it'd be 12%. So we should get the same answer except different units if you got all the way to a final answer. And you don't make any mistakes, and I don't make any mistakes. Right here. How do we handle this integral here? What's the technique?
U.
A U substitution, yeah. And what should the U be?
B minus 50.
Yeah, well, R B minus 50, but yeah. Okay. Okay, so we take the derivative, and the R is a constant, right? So we just get R. Minus 0, 50 is a constant. So the du is just r times dp, I think. Now, we don't have a du here, we have a db, so actually what I'm going to do is I'm going to solve for db. I'm going to get that. So put these two things together. Well, maybe you want to say it's three things. U is going to be the new denominator. Du over R will be the new numerator. And we know that whatever this is, it has to equal T plus C. Maybe I should write that on the left side. Okay. Now right here, you can factor out the constant R. And now there's a possibility here that, remember, with, when you take this antiderivative, what kind of function do you get? It's a
natural log.
Yeah, it's a, let's write it this way, it's 1 over u times u. There's a function we know that has the natural, it's the natural logarithm function, its derivative is the reciprocal function. Mm-hmm. Yeah, ln. Yeah. Now the caveat is, if u is negative, then you can't plug in a negative number into the logarithm. The trick was to plug in negative u into the logarithm if u is negative. Now remember, I was talking earlier about this thing here, right? RB minus 50, right? If you plug in, say, the 2,000, for example, 2,000 times 0.1 is 20 minus 50 is negative 30. At the starting balance,
point 0.1 times 2,000 minus 50 is 20 minus 50, which is negative 30, which is less than 0.
So the u value is going to start out negative, and it's going to stay negative. Remember, I talked about how we should expect this to actually go from negative 30 towards negative 50 as we pay it off. So this is actually going to be the log of negative u. That will give us the correct antiderivative here. In general, we have this rule here. This will get you the antiderivative for both cases, and it'll make sure that you don't try and plug in a negative number into a logarithm. And I don't need a plus c on this side of the equation, because if I had one, I could just subtract it from both sides and combine it with the constant over there. So I can just put all my constants of integration into that one constant over there. Okay. So we have this thing, and we can write it in terms of our original variable, RB minus 50. And so what remains, I guess we make some labels the steps. This is step 1, step 2. And we got step 3 here with the, I guess, the u substitution. And then step 4. And then I had to be careful with the business about the negatives. That comes into here. And then step 6, I'm going to solve for c. See, I know when time is 0, the balance is 2,000. So 0 plus c, plugging in 0 for t, gives me 1 over r times the logarithm of r times... You know what? I went through that whole thing about taking the negative of u, and then I didn't actually do it. Right? If I take the negative of u, I get 50 minus rb, right? There we go. Okay. So we get, taking the negative, we get 50 minus r times 2,000. We computed that thing up here. We computed it the other way. You know, rb minus 50 came out to negative 30. 50 minus rb will come out to 30 now. Again, when the balance is at the initial 2,000. And 1 over r is 1 over 0.01, so reciprocal is actually going to be 100. So we end up with C is equal to 100 times the natural log of 30. Okay, so now when B equals 0, we'll figure out what time it is, okay? So T plus C will be T plus the thing we just got for C. Okay. So this is T plus C, and T plus C equals the 1 over R, which is 100 times the log of 50 minus R times B. But we're looking at when the balance is finally paid off, so that'll be 50 minus 0. So what I did there, this thing here, these, I'm just plugging in 0 for B here, simplifying the 1 over R to 100. And the plus C, right, is coming in here. And if you like, the T plus C is coming from over here. So it all fits together. Okay. So there you go. T plus 100 times the log of 30 equals 100 times the log of 50. So now we wanted to know when this happens, right? When is the balance finally paid off? The answer is 100 times the log of 50 minus the log of 30. If you want to be fancy about it, you can use a logarithm rule and turn it into 100 times the log of 5/3. I did all my... I said the answer should be somewhere between 40 and 70, so let's see. I'm going to calculate it. Give me a decimal here. Okay. 51 point one. Rounding to the nearest month, it's 51 months. If you want to be picky about it, it's 51.0825 months. So slightly more than 51 months. And so that's how long it would take to pay it off. How much would you pay? Well, $50 a month in payments times 51 months, that's about $2,500. If you want, you can use the fact that it's actually 51.08, et cetera, months to make that a slightly better estimate. It would be 2,554, say, rounding to the nearest dollar.
What did you do in part three?
I made a U substitution. See, this integral here, I can't just take the antiderivative of this is not simply the log of RB minus 50, right?
And for all the rest, too. For all of them, you did that. Like, du over dv.
Yeah, this stuff. See, you have this equation. You have this integral here, and thanks to my step three, it becomes this integral over here. Right? This is an easier integral to do than this one. Or maybe you had your calculator give you a formula for that integral. I don't know. But I mean, that's what step three is about, is turning this into that.
But how did you get the r minus zero?
R minus zero?
Part three.
Well, I'm taking a derivative. See, here I'm thinking of u as a function of b. So think of it as y equals rx minus 50, and take the derivative, right? The slope will be r.
Right? R is a constant here. It's 0.01.
Does that help? You can write it like this. 0.01b minus 50. Then the derivative is 0.01.
Does that make it any better?
If you like, think of that as an x, right? 0.01x minus 50 has derivative 0.01. Okay?
We're taking a derivative.
This just means the derivative.
That's all we're doing.
You always have to take a derivative when you do a u substitution. So. Because if you don't, this differential term here won't be transformed properly. You'll notice that we got this 1 over r factor here, right? It came from the substitution.
Your book actually gives you a formula
for integrals of this form. So if you want, you can just memorize the formula for integrals of this form
if you don't like doing the u substitution every time. They figured it came up often enough. That would be in section 13.3 if you want to put that formula. Let's see here. I could write it, except the board is so full. But, let me see here. Tell you that if you look, I really should have that. Okay, it must be in the back. There's a table of integrals in the back. And if I can find it, Appendix C, there it is. Right? Yeah. If you look in Appendix C, you find something you might like. Related to that integral.
That U substitution we just did is part of the general pattern. Whenever you have an integral like this, I think this is integral number 3, right, in their table of integrals, and it's in the back of the book. So if you don't like doing the U substitution, and you think you're going to have to do a lot of integrals like that, I suppose you could memorize that formula. You have to remember about what the absolute value means and so on. There should be a plus C on that. That'd be an alternative if you don't trust yourself to do the U substitution. Anyways, let's get back to the area between curves, a new topic for today. Okay. So, several applications are discussed in that section. Again, I'm going to focus on this economics one, consumer and producer surplus. Has anyone heard of those terms before taking an economics class, perhaps? Yeah.
Or what?
Consumer surplus, producer surplus.
Yeah.
Yes. So the idea is they're selling a cup of nice coffee for, I don't know, $2, and you really want coffee, so you would have paid $5, right, for that cup of coffee because you really wanted it. So you pay $2. And you get this coffee that's worth $5 to you. Most days I don't think I'd pay that much. But in that hypothetical, you have a surplus in the sense of $3, right? You got something that was worth $5 to you, at least at the moment, and it only cost you $2. And the idea of the consumer surplus is to add up all of that surplus over everybody that buys it. And if somebody buys 10 cups of coffee, and each of those cups was worth, I don't know, $3 to them, but they only had to pay $2 per cup, then they have a surplus of $10, so to speak, because those 10 cups of coffee that they bought for their morning business meeting or whatever, it was worth $30 to them in value, but they only had to pay $20. So the way you add it up is actually not over per person, but you add it up over per coffee cup. Right? So for each coffee cup, you take the value of that coffee cup to whoever bought it minus what they actually paid for it. And that's the consumer surplus. Now this adding up we can model with an integral. We have one curve which represents how much the stuff is worth to people. That's the demand curve. We've seen those before in all these supply and demand problems, where if the price is P, this much is demanded. And then the lower curve will just be a flat line. It'll be the price as it was actually charged. Okay. So if we have a picture like this. So here is some... price, quantity, so there's some function d of x, and this says that if the price is here, if the price is here, then people are willing to, there's enough people willing to buy enough of whatever we're selling to actually make the total quantity demanded be this much. Now, you can't buy coffee for a nickel, probably. You probably can't find a restaurant that'll sell you a cup of coffee for a nickel, right? That would give you a lot of consumer surplus, but it wouldn't give the barista or the owner of the coffee shop any surplus, right? Because it costs them more than a nickel to give you a cup of coffee. So we end up with the other half of this. Supply curve. The supply curve says, okay, if the price is such and such, I like to think about it in terms of if the price is such and such, then this much will be supplied. But unfortunately, the way the formulas are written, it's kind of backwards. It's like, okay, in order to have this much quantity demanded, you need to make the price be this low. And in order to have the quantity supplied be this much, you need to raise the price this high. So, for example, in this picture, if you had this price, the quantity supplied would be way over there, right? If the price was that high, there'd be a lot of people trying to sell. And not enough takers, right? So the price is not going to be that high, because if we get into this situation, there's going to be people that can't sell all their coffee or whatever they're selling, and so they're going to lower prices so that they can actually sell what they're producing. So we end up with the equilibrium. So we end up with an equilibrium price. We also end up with an equilibrium quantity. Right? That'll be the horizontal coordinate. Okay. And so the way we model this is we figure out what is that equilibrium price. That'll be the price that's actually charged. Because we're going to assume things are in equilibrium, that there isn't this kind of situation where there's a huge excess supply that nobody wants to buy. Nor are we going to be in the situation where the price is too low and there's not enough. People want to buy more, but they can't because it's all sold out. We're going to assume we're in equilibrium. And then what I was talking about earlier about the consumer surplus, that will be this area right here. Okay. In equilibrium, this many coffee cups or whatever get sold, and for each coffee cup, the difference between the price it's sold at and the value that the person who bought that coffee cup placed on it is actually right here. The idea is you order the coffee cups from the most valued one to the least valued one. So the most valued coffee cup is right here at the front. Right? The person desperately wanted that coffee cup had way too much money to waste and was going to pay $10 for that coffee cup. Right? So the first coffee cup is right here at $10, say. Right, even though the equilibrium price is down at $4 or whatever. So the first coffee cup gave its purchaser a $6 surplus. And then maybe the next person was not so rich or not so crazy, at least not quite as much. And so the next coffee cup was only worth $9 or whatever. And then minus, say, a $4 equilibrium price, that person got a $5 benefit, and so on. Until we get down here near equilibrium, where there's the least valued coffee cup that was bought. This person, the coffee cup was worth $4.20 to them, say, but the equilibrium price was $4. So they hardly got any surplus at all. 20 cents surplus. It was just barely worth it to them to get this cup of coffee. I hope these are nice, sweet coffees, the fancy stuff, like mochas or something at Starbucks.
Anyways, even Starbucks is not going to charge you $4 just for plain coffee.
So that would be the concept.
And then there's also the mirror image concept of what's called the producer surplus,
which is the area down here. Maybe I should use red because I already used the green in another way. Okay, so that's how we
think about it.
Now, the mathematics of it is, I guess, step zero. You're given formulas. And then you solve P equals D of X equals S of X. Solve it for X to get what's called the equilibrium price, or equilibrium quantity, sorry. Sometimes people like to put a star on it, or sometimes people like to put a subscript EQ, whatever. Right. Or whatever your symbol is, right? For equilibrium quantity. I think the book uses a star.
Double check. No, they use a bar.
Okay. Then you can easily get the equilibrium price. Just plug it into either the demand curve, and I'll put a bar on it since the book is using a bar. Okay. So the demand curve and the supply curve meet here, so you can either plug into the demand curve or the supply curve, whichever is easier, and you get your equilibrium price. And then we can finally actually do some integrals. Okay. So the consumer surplus will be this area, and the top curve will just be the demand function. This line in the middle is just given by what? It's given by P equals P bar. Right? Equilibrium price. Right? So the consumer surplus, which I abbreviated CS, is going to be the integral. So we're going to find the area as quantity goes from 0 all the way to equilibrium quantity. So from 0 to what the book calls x bar of Now the top curve is the demand function, and then the bottom curve for this area is just this constant function. So this will just be some number. And you can also get the producer surplus. Some problems only ask for one, right? But some ask for both. So for the producer surplus, what would I integrate? Whoops. It's going to go from 0 to x bar. What's the top curve's formula going to be?
S of x.
No, that's actually on the bottom, right? The supply curve is down here. The top for this area here is p bar, right? That's on top. So we take the top curve minus the bottom curve. So this is area between curves again, and it's already right here, right? To confine the area, you go from left to right, top curve minus bottom curve. Okay. So we can look at one of these. So for example, here's 14.2 number. Okay, number 63. All right. Functions. Okay. X. Okay. I think this. This means, I guess for emphasis, let me put the bars on this, right? Because this equation is only true at the equilibrium quantity. Okay? So the equilibrium quantity is 260 units of whatever is being bought and sold. And then the equilibrium price will be, you can plug in the 260 into either of these, and you should get the same number. If I plug in 260 into here, I get 50 minus 26. If I had plugged it in here, I would get 11 plus 0.05 times 260, so I'd get 11 plus 13. I would have got the same thing. Both are going to give me 24. Right? That was the whole point of solving the equation step one. So you can plug into either one, whichever is easier. So there's a nice 260 equilibrium quantity, and then 24 is the equilibrium price. So then we can do integrals. So the consumer surplus will be an integral from x equals 0 to x equals 260. And what are we integrating? We're integrating the demand, so 50, minus 0.1x, and then minus equilibrium price, so minus 24. And the producer surplus will be also an integral from x equals 0 on the left to x equals 260 on the right. And this time it will be the equilibrium price 24 minus the supply price. So minus 11 and minus 0.05x. And you run these numbers. Let's see. I think these supply curves are actually straight. The supply and demand curves here are actually straight lines if you look at the formula. So in this case, they're not going to be truly curvy, right? They'll actually just be slanted lines. So these will just be areas of triangles. So I could actually figure out the area without an integral. I can also ask my calculator to do the integral for me. Find out. So, let's see. I think this would be a triangle with base 260 and height 26. So it should be half of 260 times 26, which is... What is that? About 30,000? No. Yeah, about 3,000 something. Anyways. 3,380, says the calculator. And I can do the other one. It's going to be 13 minus 0.05x. So this would be a triangle with a base of 260 and a height of only 13. So I think it's going to work out to be half of what the consumer surplus was. Yep. 1,690. That's how it's done. And these integrals are not hard. The book is purposefully picking integrals that are not impossible to do by hand. Right? You don't need a calculator to do these integrals.
Can you go over into step one?
Step one. I'm solving for demand price equals supply price. Right? This equals that. D of x equals S of x. That's my step one over here.
Can you reduce them?
Well, I added 0.1x to both sides, and I subtracted 11 from both sides, okay? So this is fine?
Yeah.
And then I solve for x. 39 divided by 0.15 will give you 260 in your calculator. I guess I felt like not doing it with the calculator here, so I divided both sides by 3, and then I multiplied both sides by 20. Okay. That's what I did here. And if I'd done it in the calculator, 39 divided by 0.15 would have also gotten me 260. But I knew that I knew I could get this without the calculator. It was actually faster for me to do this than to get out my calculator because, see this, I knew that 0.05 I could get its reciprocal easily. It's 20. So I just had to divide by 3, and I looked over there, and hey, 39 is a multiple of 3. So I went for it. Okay. So
I will give you some homework for you to try this stuff out. And this homework's not due for a while, because next Thursday, right, we have a test.
This
is the Thursday. This is day 20. Tuesday next week, we'll do a review, so you can ask about whatever you want to ask about. And then Thursday, day 22, we have a test on days 8 through 18. Okay, so it won't be a test on this, but okay, because of that, homeworks 19 and 20 are not due for a while because we have a test coming up.
Do we have
a
test on the 31st?
The 31st is a Monday.
But is there going to be school?
Yes. If one of your professors that teaches on Monday canceled class, he or she is not supposed to. Anyways, Tuesday, November 1st, review. Thursday, November 3rd, test. All right. Let me grab some of these problems here. Okay, so.
Chapter 14 might not be on the test?
No, it's not. Days 8 through 18. Days 8 through 18. So, if you look back, day 8, we were still at looking at stuff in chapter 11, I believe. Yep. Day 8, day 9, we were in chapter 11. Day 10, we were in chapter 12. There was a test and review on days 11 and 12. Day 13... Day 14, day 15, day 16, day 17, day 18. That was all chapters 12 and 13. Corresponds to the last three homework batches. Anyways, we're getting over time here, but. Days 8 through 18. Okay. I'll get you some solutions to this most recent homework set as soon as possible. I'll post them to the website. So you can think about questions to ask on Tuesday.